calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it looks like it's coming out in Mexico. It looks like the real story may be coming out. We'll see. We're gonna have to watch and see how this breaks. Narconews.com reporting it. A couple of other websites reporting this. Some Mexican websites reporting it, but it's not official. At least it's not in the mainstream media yet. But here's the what seems to be with those caveats. Okay, with those caveats, I think it's sufficiently credible that I'm going to talk about it here. The Mexico partial recount looks like so far the court, what's it called, TEFE? Yeah, TRIFE, the Mexican Electoral Commission, had ordered a recount of 11,839 districts or precincts, voting precincts. This is about 9% of Mexico's total of 130,000 precincts. The question being, what do you do? What does a country do when it looks like an election has been stolen? Well, in the United States in 2000, what we did was we took it to the Supreme Court. And actually, it wasn't we who took it to the Supreme Court. It was Jim Baker, John Roberts, and George W. Bush who took it to the Supreme Court. And it was decided by a few Supreme Court judges who had relatives working for the Republican Party and who were appointed by Bush Sr. And, you know, but anyhow, that's old history. So, and we're going to talk in a few minutes about what are they doing in Ohio and what, you know, what are we going to do in the United States in 2006 and 2008. But here's what's going on in Mexico, just first of all, as a frame for this thing. The recount so far looks like the election was stolen. Total amounts of ballots, either stolen or forged, adds up to, so far, now this is 7,442 precincts, about 70% of the ballots recounted, had either stolen or forged ballots, adding up to 126,282 altered votes. Now, here's the problem. The way that they're finding this out is they're finding ballot boxes that have more votes in them, more, you know, pieces of paper with votes on them in them than there were registered voters for that area. So it was clearly stuffed. Okay. And the stuffing seems to follow the Calderon, strongholds in those areas that... Well, here, I'll just read you the... This is the story. Al Giordano, writing... Again, this particular version is at narconews.com. Finally, the hard numbers are starting to come in. He says, in the partial recount of paper ballots from the July 2nd presidential election in Mexico, the recount has been completed in 10,679 of the 11,839 precincts ordered by the court. That's 9%. From these precincts... Narco News has obtained the following preliminary numbers that confirm the mass... This is a website that reports heavily on South and Central American news that confirm the massive and systematic electoral fraud inflicted on the Mexican people. In 3,074 precincts, 29% of those recounted, 45,890 illegal votes above the number of voters who cast ballots in each polling place were found stuffed inside the ballot boxes. This is an average of 15 stuffed votes in each of the precincts, primarily in strongholds for the National Action Party, also known as PAN, which is the president, Vicente Fox's party, and Felipe Calderon, the guy who was declared the winner, the conservative candidate. Additionally, in 4,368 precincts, 41% of those recounted, 80,392 ballots of citizens who did vote are missing. That's an average of 18 votes in each of those precincts. So in the precincts that were the Calderon areas, there seems to be an average of 15 votes stuffed in per precinct. And in those precincts that were López Obrador precincts, it seems that there's an average of about 18 votes per precinct removed. Together, these 7,442 precincts contain about 70% of the ballots recounted. The total adds up to 126,282 altered. Now, keep in mind, this is an election in which Calderon officially won by only 243,000 votes. This is, and they've found 126,000 phony votes, and that's with only 9% of the precincts looked at. So, you know, if you draw this out, if you project this nationwide, this is actually 8.2% so far. If you project this nationwide, it would mean that more than 1.5 million votes were either stolen or stuffed in an election that the first official count claimed was won by Calderon by only 243,000 votes. This is not all that dissimilar from what happened in Ohio in 2004 or what happened in Florida in 2000. In both cases, we know now, you know, we can look back in retrospect, documentation is quite clear, the paper trail is there. All that's missing is an administration that's willing to prosecute the malefactors. We know that in both cases, the winner was not George W. Bush. And there are other races around the country that are highly suspect. Max Cleland, for example, in Georgia, all the polls before the election showed that he was beating Saxby Chambliss, the Republican. Max Cleland, a war hero who lost three limbs on the battlefield in Vietnam. And Saxby Chambliss, who ran against him as a Republican, who was a draft dodger during the Vietnam War, and yet ran on a platform of being that Max Cleland was soft on the military somehow. I mean, go figure, right? Cleland was on the Senate Defense Committee, the committee that oversees military, and the whole thing. I mean, you know, Max Cleland was like the guy to go for, the go-to guy for the military. And the polls before and after the election showed that Max Cleland won, but the electronic voting machines in Georgia, the first state to have entirely 100% electronic voting machines with no paper trail whatsoever and no ability to audit. You know, there's no way to hand recount an electronic vote. All you've got are numbers on silicon. The electronic voting machines handed the election to the Republican. That was in the 2002 election. I'm convinced that that one was stolen in Georgia. And I think that there's substantial evidence of that. And then, of course, the 2004 election, you have Robert Kennedy's piece in Salon Magazine, in Rolling Stone. It was attacked in Salon, oddly, which has now come up with, I guess, they're redeeming themselves. But Robert Kennedy coming out and saying, you know, we can document over 300,000 votes that were stolen in Ohio, a state that George W. Bush achieved the status of the presidency by winning by just over 100,000 votes. So it's not all that different. Now, they go on to note in this, these are the, you know, as I said, this is the early story about what's happening in Mexico. If the TRIFE, or however you say this, T-R-I-F-E, I'm assuming it's TRIFE, follows the law and its own established precedents and annuls the result of these 7,442 precincts where the fraud took place. These are just the ones that they looked at. It would reverse the official results, and López Obrador would emerge the victor by more than 425,000 votes nationwide. That's about twice what he is supposed to have lost by. Here's how it would break out. Calderon would lose 1,225,000 votes, and López Obrador would lose 556,000 votes if they just said, okay, all these precincts where we have evidence, clear evidence, that either votes have been stuffed in or ripped out, we're just going to knock out all of them. We're not even going to count any of them. Then the results are different. In other words, they note in the story over at narconews.com, in other words, if the Supreme Court Electoral Court determines that only half of the problematic districts are to be annulled, López Obrador would still be declared the presidential victor. To continue to impose Calderon at this point would require the court's endorsement of results from at least 4,000 precincts that the recount has demonstrated were scenes of the electoral crimes of ballot stuffing and ballot theft. Now, they have until August 31st, this is a constitutional deadline, August 31st, to complete their computations, and that's when the official word is going to come out. It'll be at the end of this month, so it'll be another week or so. And a week and a half or so. And by September 6th, they have to either declare a presidential winner or annul the elections and say, okay, we're going to start over. Obrador has already announced that if the TRIFE tries to impose Calderon, there will be civil resistance. At the halls of Congress on September 1st, when Vicente Fox hands over the Well, actually, it's not the handover. It's when he gives his official State of the Union address. And then on Mexico's National Independence Day, September 15th, there's going to be civil disobedience. Boy, if John Kerry had only, you know, if John Kerry had only. And then we have this story about what's going on in the United States, vote suppression. And not only that, you have term limits, and this in the Associated Press today, the headline, Ohio study, vote troubles far from over. Yeah, they're going to steal the election again in Ohio in 2006. What can we do about this? What do we know about this? What steps should we be taking? We'll be covering that in this hour. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, you can burn my house, steal my car, drink my liquor from an old fruit jar. Well, do anything that you want to do. Honey, lay off of my shoes and don't you step on my blue suede shoes.
And today's also the day that Elvis, along with a whole bunch of pigeons, were taken up into the great spaceship in the sky. Yes, I'm combining my conspiracy theories here. If you believe that Elvis is actually dead, today is the day he died. And those people who have made a religion out of his life and death, you know, wearing little chains around their necks, little toilet bowls. And I'm, you know, the other day, more pigeons. Wherever the world leaders are gathered, there are pigeons there. What's the connection between pigeons and Elvis? Here we go. Wherever you see world leaders gathered, there you will find big flocks of pigeons. And I have a friend who somewhat seriously suggests that they're actually space aliens. And they're robots. They're checking up on us. And the reason how he knows is because you never see a baby pigeon and you never see a dead pigeon. And the mothership comes down every 6 months or so and just takes them all up and you know, takes back, you know, unrecords the recordings or downloads the recordings and listens to what's going on Earth. Because whenever you have meetings of world leaders, there's always pigeons there. So maybe Elvis went up in the ship with them. Who knows? Anyhow, today's the day. Salon is profiling. What are your thoughts on this? What should we do about this? What can we do about this? I'll tell you my thoughts on it. My thoughts are that we need to, number one, we need to be talking about it. We need to be talking about it loudly. We need to be talking about it a lot. We need to be talking about it to our elected officials. We need to be raising hell about it. We need to be joining folks like Bobby Kennedy and some of the folks in Ohio and Paul Leto in Washington State filed a lawsuit. I mean, actually getting out there and litigating these things. We need to be calling these guys to account. And pointing out this theft, and we need to be repeating it over and over and over again. Now, in addition to the traditional classic thing of, okay, if they're going to steal 5 million votes this year, we need to win by 6 million. That's the strategy in my mind. And I think that in Washington State, where those of you who don't live near Washington State, you know, what happened was that Christine Gregoire, the governor of Washington, won in a squeaker. And Dina Rossi, her Republican challenger, for months kept going, oh, she stole the election. Oh, they, you know, they've got dead people voting. Quack, 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 quack. You know, it just went on and on and on. Seemed to never end. And they did a series of recounts. And they found out that, in fact, she actually did win. I mean, you know, when they did the real recounts. And so, yeah, and that could have been done in Ohio. But John Kerry didn't make the kind of noise that Rossi made in Washington. And I just find it amazing that the Democrats have bought this idea that if they speak out about stolen elections, they're going to be called conspiracy nuts. But when a Republican speaks out about a stolen election, in this case in Washington State, what he perceived as a stolen election, what he gets is a due process. He gets legal action that checks out whether or not the election was stolen. And I just, you know, we need to do the spine transplant with the Democrats. We need to be calling these guys out. We need to be talking about what's going on. Here are the states. Salon's Shameful Six. Art Levine over in Salon.com talking about this. Arizona, he says, Arizona is now the only state in the country to require proof of citizenship for voter registration. Now, that's That's substantial. They go on to say, Art also in his Salon piece, he says, despite right-wing fear-mongering, hordes of unwashed illegal immigrants are not lining up at polling places to vote. In Arizona, out of 2.6 million registered voters, a handful of legal resident non-citizens who responded to voting registration drives has been charged with crimes in the last year or so. But according to the Arizona ACLU, there hasn't been a single case in state history of an illegal immigrant charged with falsely voting. Not a single case. Not one. None. Zero. Zip. Nada. Yet. None. And yet, nonetheless, they got this law passed. I mean, this the Republicans pushing this. Now, why would they do this? Well, you see, in Arizona, Republican Senator John Kyle might actually lose. And there are two incumbent GOP representatives, Republicans in Congress from Arizona, who are at risk. In Indiana, the Republican Representative Chris Ciccola, John Hostetler, and Mike Sodrell are all within striking distance of the Democratic challenge. You've got three Republicans at risk in Indiana. So in Indiana, what are they doing? As written in Salon Magazine, whether it's thousands of voters purged from county registration rolls this year without due process or new and arcane photo ID rules that can trip up even the most dedicated voter, state and county GOP election officials are seemingly seeking to discourage voter participation, perhaps because three of the most competitive U.S. House races this year are in Indiana. I think this from William Groth, an attorney filing a lawsuit challenging the voter ID law on behalf of the Indiana Democratic Party. And good on you, William Groth, for filing a lawsuit. He says, I think this is all part of a nationwide effort by the Republican Party to suppress votes because that's the only way for them to stay in power. Now, that's just two of the six states. We'll go through the rest of them and be taking your calls. Our toll-free number, 866-440-8466. After this, what can we do about the theft of our elections? And how do we stop this thing? How do we make it, how do we bring back clean elections in the United States of America? 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
You know I can be found, sit home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please telephone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Remember Elvis Day. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. I'm telling you, we have to bring it back. In today's Associated Press, problems with elections in Ohio's most populous county. This is not from some left-wing blog or something. I'm just reading this straight. Associated Press story, Connie Maben, today's newspaper. Problems with elections in Ohio's most populous county are so severe that it's unlikely they can be fixed completely by November or even by the 2008 presidential election, a report commissioned by Cuyahoga County and released Tuesday says. Incredible. Incredible. Here's another one. This from the Associated Press. This is an older story. This is from a while ago. A defective computer chip in the county's optical scanner misread ballots Tuesday night and incorrectly tallied a landslide victory for Republicans. This was a story in the Associated Press on November 7th. Right after the 2002 election. The story added, Democrats actually won by wide margins. Now, how was it that the Republicans were given the election by the electronic voting machines, but the Associated Press later figured out that the Democrats actually won? Well, here's the story. The Republicans would have carried the day had not poll workers become suspicious when the computerized vote reading machine said the Republican candidate was trouncing his incumbent Democratic opponent in the race for county commissioner. The poll workers were close enough to electorate. They were part of the electorate to know their county overwhelmingly favored the Democratic incumbent. incumbent. A quick hand recount of the optical scan ballots. See, these were not even touchscreen machines. These were fill in the sheet and then feed it through a machine, right? The optical scan ballots showed that the Democrat had indeed won, even though the computerized ballot scanning machine kept giving the race to the Republican. The poll workers brought the discrepancy to the attention of the county clerk, who notified the voting machine company. As the Associated Press reported, County Clerk Lindsay said, quote, a new computer chip was flown to Snyder, Texas from Dallas. With the new chip installed, the computer then verified that the Democrat had won the election. In another Texas anomaly, Republican State Senator Jeff Wentworth won his race with exactly 18,181 votes. This is the 2002 election. Republican Carter Castile won her state house seat with exactly 18,181 votes. And conservative Judge Danny Scheel won his seat with exactly 18,181 votes, all in Comal County, Texas. No poll workers apparently thought to ask for a new chip for a recount on that, even though three ultra-conservatives all won by the exact same number of votes. I mentioned Max Cleland, the race in November. USA Today reported on November 3rd, 2002, quote, in Georgia, an Atlanta Journal-Constitution poll shows Democratic Senator Max Cleland with a 49-44% lead over Republican Saxby Chambliss. This was 3 days before the 4 days before the election. Cox News Service, based in Atlanta, reported that just after the election, excuse me, this was 2 days before the election, reported that just after the election on November 7th, quote, pollsters may have goofed because Republican Representative Saxby Chambliss defeated incumbent Democratic Senator Max Cleland by a margin of 53-46%. That's just about exactly what they were expecting Cleland was going to win by. The Hotline, a political news service, I'm quoting from the Cox News Service here now. The Hotline, a political news service, recalled a series of polls Wednesday showing that Chambliss had been ahead in none of them. The guy who's sitting in the United States Senate right now, the Vietnam draft dodger who ran on a campaign of I'll keep America safe from terror, Saxby Chambliss, he was ahead in none of the polls, and yet the electronic voting machines gave the election to him. Just as amazing was the Georgia governor's race, also tabulated, of course, on paperless electronic voting machines. Similarly, the Zogby polling organization reported on November 7, quote, no polls predicted the upset victory in Georgia of Republican Sonny Perdue over incumbent Democratic Governor Roy Barnes. Here you had an incumbent Democratic governor who's very popular. Perdue won by a margin of 52-45%. I'm still quoting from the Zogby report. Perdue won by a margin of 52-45%. The most recent Mason-Dixon poll had shown Barnes ahead 48-39% last month with a margin of error plus or minus 4%. End of quote from the Zogby report. In other words, in these two major races in Georgia, the Republican won by the exact margin, or very close to the exact margin, that the Democrat was ahead in the polls. You tell me something's not wrong. And then now we've got this thing from this piece, Vote Suppression Sweeps the Nation. This is in Salon Magazine, or, you know, the online salon.com, where they're documenting state after state where the Republicans are already getting this stuff ready. They're getting ready to steal another election. Where will the next, I shared with you Indiana last, Ohio, Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell, now the Republican candidate for governor, is using some new vote suppressing tactics, and this time he's got a sweeping, if confusing, law, HB 3, to back him up. Democrats could take the governor's mansion and unseat Senator Mike DeWine and four House incumbents. That's what's at stake in Ohio. Well, the Ohio Republicans are not going to let that, they're not going to let an election get in the way of that. In California, earlier this year, Connie McCormick, the Los Angeles County Registrar and a Democrat, went public with her concerns that 43% of all new registered voters in her huge county were being disqualified. But she only went public after Republican Secretary of State Bruce McPherson did not respond to her private complaints. He said, why does anybody need to be dumped over files that don't match, she asked. She's talking about people who are being dumped from the files because there's some small discrepancy in their address. Gee, if I live on road and it's RD on my voter registration and it's ROAD on my driver's license, I don't get to vote in California. I mean, is it that kind of thing? 11% of L.A. County's newly registered voters have been disqualified so far, and it will get worse in November, so far in 2006. Schwarzenegger is vulnerable. Three Republican House incumbents vulnerable. And you've got Paul Weyrich, the architect, the main man, the brains behind the Republican machine, just coming right out and saying it.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And the voting populace is going down all across the United States. I'm telling you. And this is just plain old, flat out wrong. Jeff in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I'm terrified of what they're planning on doing up here in Washington. And we got Maria Cantwell running for re-election. We've got possibly able to take over Reichert's seat. But the reason I called, I just wanted to correct you on the Dino Rossi thing.
Okay.
The recount was actually mandated by state law. The margin in the election was so small that it required the first recount was a machine recount, and then the second recount is a manual recount, both of which were required by state law because of the margin.
Because outside the elections. Thank you for that correction, Jeff. And yet, at the same time, you had Rossi out there yelling loudly in the media that he believed that there was vote fraud on the part of the Democrats.
Absolutely. And he still, even after the manual recount, he still claimed that he won, but he finally gave up.
But he finally gave up. But the point is that he kept fighting the good fight, and you know, grudgingly, I have to say, you know, good on him for fighting the good fight. If he believed that he was right, and where was John Kerry at the same time?
I agree. That's the same thing. I cannot. When I first saw the video of Gore, when he did not let the Black Caucus speak.
Yeah, you're talking about in Fahrenheit 9/11 in Michael Moore's movie.
Well, with the first, I guess that was where I must have seen it, but when he sat there and he said, no, you cannot, he didn't fight. He wasn't willing to fight.
Yeah, they just needed one senator to challenge that election.
Absolutely.
And he was unwilling to be that senator. Well, you can understand that he would be unwilling to be that senator because he was the candidate, and that may seem unseemly. I mean, you know, these guys all try to be very politically correct. But you would think that there would be one other Democrat with a spine.
Yeah, well, he asked people not to, and that was the problem.
Yeah, okay, all right, yeah.
Anyway, thanks a lot, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Craig in Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, Craig, what's on your mind?
I just thought I'd give you some good news. We got all the presidential candidates running around the Iowa State Fair.
Mm-hmm.
Big Republican booth. As last year, the year before, all had pictures of Bush and Cheney and Bush on the TV, which I always happen to shut off accidentally.
Mm-hmm.
But this year, no picture of Bush or Cheney in the Republican booth at the Iowa State Fair.
Oh, that's interesting. Here in the district that I live in, Darlene Hooley is my member of Congress, and she's being opposed by a Republican who doesn't mention on his website that he's a Republican. I mean, it's pretty incredible.
They're distancing themselves fast.
I think they're not just distancing themselves from Bush. They're distancing themselves from the word Republican in many cases. I mean, it's really, really, really quite extraordinary. And Craig, thanks a lot for the report. I'm glad to hear it. And then you've got the question. I mean, what about folks like, you know, Chuck Hagel? Chuck Hagel, maybe Nebraska Republican Chuck Hagel honestly won two U.S. Senate elections. Maybe. But, you know, he was the president of the company that sold the voting machines to the state in which he ran for the U.S. Senate, in which he scored what the Washington Post called the upset victory of the year. I mean, this is not new. This was back in 2000. Or, no, 98. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, bless my soul, what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The respected Washington, D.C. publication The Hill has confirmed that former conservative radio talk show host and employee of George Herbert Walker Bush and now Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Hagel was the head of and continues to own part interest in the company that owns the company that installed, programmed, and largely ran the voting machines that were used by most of the citizens of Nebraska. Back when Hagel first ran there for the U.S. Senate in 1996, his company's computer-controlled voting machines showed he'd won stunning upsets in both the primaries and the general election. The Washington Post on January 13, 1997 said Hagel's, quote, Senate victory against an incumbent Democratic governor was a major Republican, the major Republican upset in the November election, end quote. According to Bev Harris of BlackBoxVoting.org, Hagel won virtually every demographic group, including many largely black communities that had never before voted Republican. Hagel was the first Republican in 24 years to win a Senate seat in Nebraska. 6 years later, Hagel ran again, this time against Democrat Charlie Matulka in 2002, won in a landslide. And we've had Charlie Matulka on this program. He comes out and he says, hey, this guy, he says, this is a bigger story than Watergate ever was. They say Hagel shocked the world. He didn't shock me. I'm quoting Charlie Matulka. John Gideon is on the line. He's the executive director of VotersUnite.org in Bremerton, Washington. Hey, John.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to pass on that there is a little-known complaint process that anyone can use. It's mandated by the Help America Vote Act that every voter in the United States has the right to file a formal complaint with their state for any past, present, or future violations, potential violations of the Help America Vote Act, anything in
right, and people can find out about that over at VotersUnite.org. But John Gideon, here's the problem. I mean, you've got Jeb Bush operating under a court order saying that he has to restore those purged names that he purged in 2000. He still hasn't done it. He's violating the law. You've got Ken Blackwell violating the law in Ohio. Nobody's holding these guys accountable because they're all Republicans. The Republicans control all three branches of government, including those that would prosecute under this act.
Sure, and I guess that this process won't take care of that, but it will allow people to take care of other things such as accessibility to voting machines and so forth. I've got two filed right now in the state of Washington, and they're right now, sometime probably next week or the week after, they're going before an administrative law judge for a hearing.
Oh, good. So you're getting something done with it. So
yes.
People can learn about that, more about that at VotersUnite.org.
John, thanks. Vote Trust USA.
And Vote Trust USA. Great. Thanks a lot, John. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Joshua in Eugene, Oregon, listening on KTPK, is it?
Hello,
or KOPT, excuse me. Hey, Joshua. Welcome to the program.
Hey, welcome to Eugene.
Hey, I'm pleased to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you. While you were talking about voting, I want to take the opportunity to touch on the fact that every day is election day in our capitalistic society. And I think a lot of Democrats, progressives, whatever, don't take that seriously and don't think about it. They vote for the Democratic candidates every 2 years, but they're shopping at the box stores, at the fast food places. They're supporting destructive industries every day with their dollar. You know, they're not using alternative transportation.
Joshua, I agree with you that we need to be making economic decisions in our daily lives that are appropriate and support companies that support appropriate candidates. On the other hand, here's the big problem with the vote with our dollars theory. Simply said, those with the most dollars have the most votes.
Right.
And that's not democracy. Democracy is one person, one vote. And so I'm very, very wary of the meme of vote with your dollars even getting out there, frankly. I think, you know, we need to use our dollars to appropriately push technology and industry and all these kinds of things, and politics for that matter. But I don't think we should frame it as voting with our dollars.
And I just think we should be consistent with our dollars. If you're gonna say that you don't want to pollute the water or you don't want to pollute the air, I think you should try not to use alternative transportation.
Right.
And don't. Industries that do.
Yeah. Well said. Well said. I appreciate it, Joshua. Thank you very much for the call. We're nearly out of time here. Carol in Ayers, Massachusetts. Hey, Carol. What's up?
Hi. You had mentioned different things that we might be able to do, and some of the things that I've done is, I joined the ACLU. I've I joined MoveOn.org.
You've become an activist.
Yeah. I mean, I made calls for Ned Lamont during the election and just things that I probably wouldn't have otherwise done. And, you know, I don't have the money to be donating to these people, but the alternative is, you know, is 100 times worse.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't know what to do. I'm from a Democratic state, so it's hard for me to hear a lot of these things that are going on because we're kind of sheltered.
Yeah.
Being,
yeah,
you know, we, you know.
Although you do have a Republican governor there.
Yeah, we do, and hopefully that's going to change.
Yeah, there you go.
I think that's going to change.
Well, Carol, I salute your activism, and thank you very much for the call. Ted in Burlington, Vermont, we have 20, 30 seconds left. Ted.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Yes, I had a somewhat of a solution to our voter problem, and that is, one, obviously do away with all technological voting systems, go straight back to paper. It's worked for the last 200-plus years, and you have a federal ballot, a state ballot, and a local ballot. So when you walk into your voting district, you get three separate ballots, and they're all easily accountable for. And if there's any ever any question, you can always do recounts.
Good suggestion, Ted. Good one. And thank you for listening to us on WVAA there in Burlington, Vermont. The Bush administration ties all foreign policy to 9/11. How should Democrats respond? Jeffrey Feldman from Frame Shop is open. He's going to join us after the break with the frame of the week. And we'll continue this discussion as we go on throughout the day. It's 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our political history. There is a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things. Among them are a few other Texas oil millionaires and an occasional politician or businessman from other areas. Their number is negligible and they are stupid. Our quote for the day, spoken on November 8, 1954, by President Dwight D. Eisenhower. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth in Broadcasting for a Change. Jeffrey Feldman is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of FrameShopIsOpen.com and one of the nation's leading experts on framing. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Tom.
Bush shamelessly ties Lebanon to 9/11?
Yeah, I just noticed this looking over what President Bush was saying in response to developments going on in the Middle East. And I picked up a quote where it seemed as though, you know, once again, the Bush administration takes old rhetoric that they're using on Iraq and they're just recycling it to use with current events and what's going on. And in this quote, he was saying that the reason that we were supporting a particular perspective of what was going on in Lebanon had to do, once again, with what he calls the broader war on terror and what happened on 9/11. It's an incredible way that everything that the public seems to question about the president's foreign policies, his response, in order to avoid actually answering to what it is that people are saying, is to just tie it into 9/11. The implication being, of course, that if you question the president's policies, then you are in favor of what happened to the country on 9/11, which is just a terrible, terrible way to frame things.
Well, it's a very effective way to frame things if you're a Republican.
Yeah, although the Republicans lately, as I started to notice, are breaking ranks with this. Really interesting is that George Will, a noted conservative commentator in his recent column, called into question the whole approach of framing what happened in our foreign policy after 9/11 in terms of a war rather than a police action. As we all remember, if we go back to that time period, there was actually a discussion about whether or not we should think about our response in terms of a police action or a military all-out war, and the Republicans came and fell lockstep behind the Bush administration, while a few Democrats held on for a while, in particular, most noteworthy, John Kerry, saying, look, we should treat this as a crime that we need to use police for. And last week, George Will came out and said, you know what, maybe John Kerry was right back then. Maybe the Democrats had something. So effective up to this point, but it looks like perhaps it won't be as effective as it was last time going forward.
That's amazing. I've got to find that article by George Will.
Isn't that incredible?
Somehow that one slipped right by me. But you're right. Bush has been using this. Now, one of the things that I heard Ken Melman say the other day just really caught my attention, and I see that you've been blogging about it over at frameshopisopen.com. Jeffrey Feldman, I'm curious what your take is on Melman, who used to work for Karl Rove. He's now the head of the Republican National Committee, the RNC, the official spokesman for the Republican Party. And the other day he was saying, well, cut and run is not our strategy, stay the course is not our strategy. It's never been our strategy. Our strategy is to adapt and win. What's the deal here?
Yeah, I mean, Ken Melman, he was on Meet the Press when he said that, and he used that phrase, adapt and win, adapting to win, about six times in a few seconds. And it seems that what's going on is that in response to the Connecticut Democratic primary, which has been like the shot heard round the world in terms of politics in this country, where Ned Lamont beat Lieberman in this primary, it seems that the basic Republican position that we are going to stay the course is no longer a viable phrase for them to use. And so they're trying to search for a way to say that we're going to change our policy, say it, not actually do it, but say change without actually coming out and saying the word change. And so Melman used this phrase, adapt to win, which is really a way of saying, look, we're not losing, we're not staying the course, we're going to adapt to win. And he locked it in step by saying, look, this is the debate is really not what you thought it was. It's really not what we've been saying over and over and over again. And interestingly, on The Daily Show, they caught the president using the exact phrase that Melman said they were no longer using. They're going to use this new concept instead. But my sense is that they use Melman to test these phrases, and then they see if it works. And if it does work, then we're going to hear it a lot in the coming days.
And you suggest that the Democrats should throw back a frame of their own.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is a bold-faced attempt to spin a policy using new words. And I think that all Americans, basically Democrats, can say that America has no more time to waste. We simply don't have time to waste with these rhetorical strategies. The administration needs to think more about changing the policy, not just changing the words that they're using to talk about that policy, because Americans see that it's not working. That phrase, no more time to waste, is a way of really resetting the discussion and saying, look, we're not going to follow you into that rhetorical trap. We're going to talk about real substance and real ideas.
Now, to move along here, George Allen has been caught in apparently calling a fellow who was born in the United States, whose parents were of Indian ancestry, India as in the country Indian, a monkey. Using a slur that implies that or says that, and Allen is trying to weasel out of this, but basically a maque or a mac. How do you pronounce it?
Maque? The word that he used was macaca, which is this
which is a particular type of
a monkey. But what's fascinating is that it was an event in Brakes, Virginia, in kind of Southwest Virginia, in which it was Allen was speaking to an all white audience except for this one kid, this college student from UVA. He was volunteering for the Webb campaign, who was not white. His parents are from India, although he was born in United States. And Webb turned to him, and he made this remark, and he called
him. You mean Allen turned to him?
Allen turned to him, thank you. And he made this remark several times, and a lot of people were trying to figure out what this remark
was. And he said, welcome to America.
Welcome to America. And I did, a really basic Google search on this word, macaca, and I was as shocked as anybody else, but the search turned up all these instances in white power websites where this word was being used in the most kind of horrible slurs.
It's the word that is used against Indian Americans the same way that the N-word is used against African Americans.
Exactly. I mean, it's a really ugly word. And Alan comes out and says, you know, I just made this word up. I didn't mean it to be offensive in any way. And he really
hallucinated it out of thin air.
Yeah, and he's really kind of spiraling down. And yet
George Bush is going to go stump for him.
August 23rd in Richmond, he's going to go out there and do a fundraiser. John McCain's going out to campaign with him as well. And Alan has yet to come up with a viable explanation for how it is that this racist term just suddenly appeared in a campaign stop. And
well, Bush showed up at Liberty University, Bob Jones University, where interracial dating is banned or was banned for the longest at the time. I mean, these guys are not uncomfortable with racism.
Yeah, one would hope that they would be, but you know, who knows? The story is still it's still growing, and a lot of Virginia bloggers have started to talk about this, and it will be really interesting to see how people react. And coming fast on the heels of this is a financial scandal. It seems that Alan was involved with a company named Zybernaut when he was running for Senate the first time around, which is now under FEC investigation for sketchy accounting practices, kind of a classic tech boom scandal that is going to feature, George Allen right smack dab in the middle of it. We don't know exactly whether it was illegal or simply kind of sleazy in appearance type practices that Allen's involved in. But, you know, a racism scandal and a financial scandal, and here you have, the lights of the Republican Party showing up on the heels of all this stuff in order to stump for him. It's very, very troubling.
Yeah, to say the very least. We're talking with Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief of Frame Shop is open. We just have a minute left, Jeffrey. The war against toothpaste, duck and cover, is
yeah, I mean, that last week during this this so-called terrorism scare in England where they rounded all these guys up, as it turns out, possibly not as firm of an event that was destined to happen as we initially thought.
They didn't have their passports, they didn't have their visas, and they'd never built a bomb.
Exactly. Clearly, the warnings that came out from our government linked up with political developments going on in Connecticut. But I noticed that the rhetoric, you know, this idea that we needed to, in response to this, throw out, you know, things like toothpaste and shaving cream before you got on a plane, it reminded me of the Cold War era duck and cover rhetoric, where early on kids were taught, you know, if you hear a nuclear blast nearby, you know, jump off your bike and crouch next to a curb or jump off
your desk. Oh, we used to do this when I was in school. I mean, in 1956, 57, 58, when I was in elementary school, you know, first, second, third grade, the bell would go off and we'd have to dive under our desks. And we learned how to put a thumb in each ear and our fingers over our eyes so that we would protect those organs. It's amazing. Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com. Read all about it. Jeffrey, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Say the beware, take it slow. Easy come, easy go. All right.
All right, welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Telling the truth that multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Victoria Jones is with us from Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com, Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., our senior minor scoop correspondent. You have a minor scoop?
I have a minor scoop. I attended a press conference this morning with Deputy Prime Minister Shimon Peres of Israel, Nobel Prize winner, who, I must say, as an editorial comment, if he'd prosecuted this war, I can't help feeling it would have been a bit different. And he's on a four-day tour of the U.S. to raise money for rebuilding Israel. And so I asked him a question whether...
it's got to be a tough time to be doing that.
I'm sorry?
It's got to be a tough time to be doing that in some quarters. But actually, it's probably a very good time in other quarters. Pardon
exactly.
My editorial commentary here.
I think it's going to be a real mix. So I asked the question whether they would consider the possibility as a gesture of goodwill of giving some of the money they raised to the people of Lebanon to help them rebuild. So I got a lengthy answer to that. But in the course of it, he gave me information, he gave us information, which he said has never before been released. And he said the information was that during the course of the war, Israel granted permission to Arab countries to do flyovers over Israel of planes carrying aid to Lebanon. And that once they verified that they were not taking bombs, that any Arab country that wished to fly over Israel was permitted to do that. And he wanted us to know that, is that that was the kind of gesture that Israel was prepared to grant to the Arab countries.
That, you know, given that some of those countries are still officially at war with Israel, that's pretty substantial, actually.
It's pretty substantial. We attempted to find out the names of the countries. He said they would not want me to tell you the names, so he wouldn't tell me the names. I also asked him what was the very latest update on the Israeli soldiers who are the dealers to get them out. And he talked about the UN resolution, but he also said, I can tell you categorically, I think he used that word, that they are alive and they are healthy. Well, there's been a lot of speculation as to whether they in fact are, but he was absolutely certain, positive, that they are alive and they are healthy.
Well, I would think that Hezbollah would be shooting themselves in the foot, if it's a lousy metaphor, but, you know, to kill these guys because
I would think so too.
Their currency. And historically,
exactly.
You know, the Israel has been willing to exchange a few of their Israeli, whether it's soldiers or civilians, whatever it may be, citizens, in exchange for a large number of Arabs, by and large, you know. And so I would think that they would, that Lebanon would want, or the Hezbollah would want to continue to hang on to them.
Right, I would think so too, but it was interesting to have it confirmed. So there you are, there are my two scoops.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. What else is going on in Washington, D.C. today?
Very little. It's remarkably quiet. The president is leaving very shortly to go to Pennsylvania to tour a Harley-Davidson plant where he will speak about the economy. This, of course, has nothing to do with the fact that he's also going to go to a fundraiser in Pennsylvania a little bit later on for which the taxpayer will pick up the tab.
I was just going to say, how does he get away with this? I mean, my recollection is, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, that when Bill Clinton went to do fundraisers, that the Democratic National Committee or the Clinton campaign or whatever it may have been picked up part of the cost of Air Force One and all that sort of thing. And I'm seeing Bush just, you know, he's like Mr. Fundraiser-in-Chief flying all over the country all the time, and I'm not hearing anything about the RNC picking up any of the tab. Am I missing something?
I don't think you're missing anything. I've heard nothing to that effect as well. I don't believe the RNC is picking up any of the tab.
So it's you and me paying for Bush's fundraisers.
That's correct. That's exactly what we're doing, because his primary reason for traveling is to visit the Harley-Davidson plant. It just so happens that they're having these fundraisers on the same day.
I see. So he's finessing it. He's finessing it. That is so sad and so sick. Now, George Allen, the man who would be president,
he was the
great white hope, you know, to use a phrase that's perhaps appropriate in the context of him stepping in macaca here. To quote Salon's headline here, he was going to be the great hope for the Republican Party to be a presidential candidate. It looks like it's blowing up in his face now.
He's never going to be a presidential candidate. That's done, over, finished. Maybe he'll stick in the Senate, or maybe this will stick to him. It's hard to tell. That is a big local story, you know, in the same way as we had the story of the senatorial candidate in Maryland, just a gubernatorial, I can't remember which, in Maryland. Maryland just a couple of weeks ago, who put his foot in it when he was talking about being buds with Bush, basically saying they were homies. Allen is in trouble with this. He's apologized, but the apology rings hollow. There are rumors that he did know what this word meant, and if he didn't, then why did he use it? And it was inappropriate anyway. And the longer this drags on, because there's no other news and it's August, it's dragging on much longer than it probably would have done if it was September and there was something else to talk about.
Well, and George Allen having the Confederate flag hanging in his office, you know, throughout his when he was governor, that I suppose might have worked for some folks in Virginia, but I think those days are passing. I lived in Georgia when there was this big debate about getting the stars and bars off the Georgia flag, you know, but I think that America is becoming less and less tolerant of that kind of embracing a racist past.
I think it is, and I think, you know, that Virginia, particularly the Washington suburbs, is such a fast-growing area. I mean, Loudoun County is one of the fastest-growing counties in the entire nation. People moving here have no idea of Allen's past. I think they will be quite shocked to learn all this.
Yeah, that he had pictures of Confederate soldiers in his office, that he used to campaign with a Confederate flag. Yeah, amazing. Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thank you.
Thank you.
Great speaking with you today. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Big boss man, can't you hear me when I call? Big boss man, can't you hear me when I call? Can't you hear me when I call? Well, you ain't so big, you know you're just tall, that's all.
And welcome back. Yeah, today, Elvis joined the pigeons in the sky. 34 minutes past the hour. Talk radio for the rest of us. Tom Hartman here with you. What do we do? I want to continue this meme. You know, what do we do when elections get stolen? And how do we take back stolen elections? I actually have a solution for this. If you go over to TomHartman.com and click Articles on Democracy, there's an article I wrote about a year and a half ago called How to Take Back a Stolen Election. And we already know how to do it. We did it in the Ukraine. We financed that. It was financed by the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, and Freedom House, which was started by Eleanor Roosevelt and is now arguably headed up by some neocons. I mean, it's one of the former CIA director, James Woolsey's on the board, but nonetheless, that's who financed the thing. And a group of five, basically five young guys who were in Serbia who helped expose the theft of the Serbian election, were hired by us, or hired is the wrong word, were funded by us to do the same thing in Ukraine, in Soviet Georgia, and in one other of the former Soviet countries. And in these four elections, these four different attempts, they were successful in several of them. And what they did was they did what López Obrador is doing in Mexico. They said, you know, we're not going to give up. We're going to point out that this is a stolen election. We're going to demand that there be some transparency or some accountability here. We're going to get out ahead of the news cycle. I mean, López Obrador was out there saying, you know, this election, I'm smelling election on election day, before the returns were even in. He was saying, I'm seeing this thing coming. And we need to stand up and say, not only do we not want electronic voting machines that don't have paper trails, we don't want electronic voting machines that are owned by or that are programmed by or that are running software owned by private corporations. Because if you believe in the concept of the commons at all, you have to believe that, you know, the commons, those things that we collectively own, the air, the water, the our roads, our military, our police, our fire, our schools. If you believe in the concept of the commons, that there are these things that we own in common, the most vital of the commons, the thing that administers and protects all the rest of the commons, is our government. It is the commons of the commons. It's how our will is executed through our elected representatives. And the way that the commons of the commons, the way that our government is instructed in how we want them to behave, is through our vote. So you could argue that the vote is the most vital of all the commons. I mean, nobody would go out and argue that the fire departments should be run by private corp. Well, there might be a few right-wing cranks who would suggest that. But by and large, most people would not say, oh, the fire department should be run by private corporations. Police departments should be run by private corporations. They're not going to say that. Schools should be run by private corporations. They're not going to say that. I mean, yes, I get it, that there are right-wing cranks out there. They are such a minority. They really and truly don't believe in the commons. So how is it that we are accepting that the commons by which our police and our fire and our laws and everything else are administered, the vote, is now been privatized? This is a felony against democracy, an absolute felony against democracy. We need to get rid of these machines. We need to do the same thing that every other country in the world does and go back to paper. This is not rocket science. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Elizabeth in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. I'm great, but I'll get better.
Okay.
I understand you wanted to call about Clint Curtis. Clint, I'm speaking about these voting machines here. He's the guy. He's the original whistleblower.
Exactly. He was a programmer down in Florida in 2000 working for Yang Enterprises. And then State Congressman Tom Feeney, who is now a U.S. congressman, was in-house counsel for the company and the lobbyist. And he came to Clint and asked him to create vote flipping software to control the vote in Florida.
Tom Feeney, by the way, also was the guy who was the point man in the 2000 election in Florida, saying that no matter how the vote goes, the Florida House of Representatives, the Florida Senate, Florida's Congress has the right to determine who the electors are, and they're going to send George W. Bush electors to Washington, D.C., because that's actually what the Constitution says.
Right.
They're going to send Bush electors to Washington, D.C., even if Gore wins Florida.
So now you've got Clint blew the whistle when he realized what Feeney really wanted to do with the software.
Right.
And so he blew the whistle on the vote fraud as well as some espionage that was going on at Yang Enterprise. They were selling secret data from NASA to China.
Right.
And so
been busted for that since then.
Right. Clint's story reads like a spy novel. He was fired and then offered the job back with a huge salary for hush money, which he didn't accept, and his life has been threatened, and a government investigator who was investigating Clint's claims turned up mysteriously dead in a motel room. So anyway, Clint now is running for Congress against Tom Feeney, and the primary is September 5th, and if he wins this primary, he will be running opposing Tom Feeney for the congressional seat.
So he's running in the Democratic primary.
Correct.
To oppose Tom Feeney in the who's the Republican incumbent at the moment.
That's correct.
Are there other strong Democrats in this primary, or is he just...
Well, there's another Democrat that's running. I don't know too much about him. His last name is Michaud, and apparently he has run before, but this time he's in the race, but he is pretty much a no-show at any events where they're supposed to show up. He doesn't show up, and apparently he's not doing much fundraising. So nobody seems to know what to make of that.
Interesting. So Clint Curtis is now doing a tour around the country, raising money for his run for Congress.
Yeah, I don't know exactly if he's touring the country, but we are election activists here in Seattle. It's a new group that started called Citizens to Stop Computerized Voting Machines. And one of the members has been corresponding with the Curtis campaign and suggested we wanted to have a fundraiser. And, you know, they said, well, Clint will fly out there if you do it. So that's what we're doing. We're having a fundraiser tomorrow night at the Seattle Labor Temple at 7 p.m. And Clint will be there. We will be showing the documentary of his life story. It's called Murder, Spies, and Voting Lies. And it's basically it's a jaw-dropping documentary. You can't believe the things he's experienced in the course of his whistleblowing. And also Bev Harris is going to stop by and maybe talk about some ways to monitor elections here in Washington.
That's
so it should
great.
Be a pretty exciting evening.
Yeah, at the Labor...
Seattle Labor Temple. It's 2800 First Avenue in Belltown.
Tomorrow night.
Mm-hmm.
7 o'clock.
Right.
Great. Okay. Be there or be square. Elizabeth, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
And tell Clint to give us a call, if he's around town tomorrow and we have an open segment, give us a call. We'll put him on the air and talk for a few minutes.
Okay, cool.
Great. Thanks a lot, Elizabeth.
Bye-bye.
Great to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. The Commons, as you articulated, you're right. It seems to me it was a very successful structure, but wealth and ego got in America's way, I think.
What are you talking about?
Well, you're talking about the Commons, and I agree with you. I think it was a successful structure, if you will.
It still is.
It's,
we still have much of the Commons. It's under assault.
It's on the ropes.
It's under assault. But the concept of the commons is one that Americans still believe in. Americans actually want a government that works.
But I'm getting to the point why it's on the ropes.
Okay.
Wealth and ego. That's why it's on the ropes.
Yeah,
in my opinion.
I would add to that mental illness.
Mental illness.
Yeah, I'm not kidding. There are some people who are who have obsessive compulsive disorder, and the object of their obsession and compulsion is either wealth or power.
Oh, and, I agree with that.
And they end up in these positions where, you know, they're just like, you know, they're after either, you know, more money or more power. And there are some people, there are a lot of people who are public servants who are involved in politics for the right reasons. And then there are a few of them who are there because they're mentally ill. And I mean that literally.
Yes. And I agree with that. Also, I just want to add, and I'll leave you with this. I certainly agree with that. A politician focuses, you know, on the next election. That's more or less what's going on. We more or less agree with that.
Well, to some extent, we want them to, because we want them to be listening to us.
But a statesman focuses on the next generation.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Thanks.
I'll give you that, Gary. Thank you.
Well, I thought I earned it, but okay, thanks.
You're right. You did.
That's
you
all
did.
Right. Bye.
You did. I appreciate it. Yeah. Okay. Politician. Yeah. And what we want, ideally, are politicians who are statesmen and women. Stateswomen, yeah, that's a word. And that's what we're missing. That's what we are so missing right now, are politicians who are forward-looking. I mean, going back to the Iroquois Confederacy, on which part of the American Constitution was based, the idea that every decision made has to be made in the context of its impact on seven generations from now. And if you can't say that this is going to have a positive effect on the seventh generation from today, you don't do it. And just think how different our government would be. Think how different business would be if that was one of the operational rules for business, doing business in the United States or around the world. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, The True People's Radio.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. You can also drop by our live chat room at tomhartman.com. However you spell it should get you there. Just click live chat at the top of the page. Or you can scroll way down the page for all sorts of cool and interesting things. Alice in Humboldt County, listening on KGOE. Alice, one of our wise elders in your 90s now, aren't you, Alice?
Tom?
Yes. Hello, Alice.
We have asked this before, but we need to wake up Congress about all this voting fraud. It's hard for you to think of everything, but whenever you have a member of Congress with you or a candidate, can you make them aware of all this?
I will do my best. I'm going to start bringing this up with politicians more and more. I mean, there's some of them that, you know, just absolutely get it. And
they need to be awakened.
Yeah. I mean, like Bernie Sanders, I mean, he's just coming right out and saying, hey, it's time for us to start voting on paper until we can clean this stuff up. I mean, you know, let's get back to it. But he's the only one I've heard actually come out and say that so far. So, you know, we need to stay on it. Alice,
okay, Tom.
Do you remember which election you first voted in?
Pardon?
Do you remember which election, who was running for president the first time you voted?
Oh, that's way back.
Yeah, it would have been in the 30s. Might have been Roosevelt.
Oh, well, yes. That was one that was outstanding.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Alice, thank you very much for calling
us.
Okay. It's always great to hear from you.
Goodbye.
Thank you. Bob in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Well, a couple of things, Tom. One is I profess a fairly complicated economics question, but the other thing, and the more stark, is I understand you're getting dropped from the Burlington area on Monday.
Oh, you're changing stations. You're moving to a different station. But Bob, I don't want to talk programming on any of our stations on the national show. It's just something we don't do. So
okay, the other, you know, the economics.
Let's go to the economics question.
Back when OPEC did the, crisis back in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
they were setting the price, they were controlling it, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
Now everything seems to be being done on the spot market. And I'm wondering, who's controlling the quantities that are being sold and bought? And are the oil companies essentially just manipulating their own price through a third party?
I would suggest that the interests of the oil companies and the interests of OPEC are so in line with each other right now.
But you don't hear anything about OPEC these days.
Well, they're still meeting, and they're still fixing the price of oil largely by determining how much oil Saudi Arabia produces. But as I said, the oil companies themselves also have some say in this. I think OPEC is accounting now for about 40% of world supply. I may be real wrong on that, but that's my recollection, and which is enough to be the tail that wags the dog of price, but not entirely. And so you get things like, Prudhoe Bay going down and the price of oil goes up 70 cents, but it's not going to go up $20. That's going to be something that OPEC is going to have, is going to make happen.
Well, Bernie just showed the Who Killed the Electric Car movie up here.
Oh, great.
We're still trying to drag you up for a fundraiser, giving Louise the elbow there.
Yeah, oh, I'd love to.
And that's where the context of the getting dropped from the station fits in. Because
yeah, well, again, as I said, Bob, we don't talk programming on the program, but I know that the signal, you're changing stations there from one station to another. But, Bob, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. Myrna in, is it Puyallup, Washington?
It's Puyallup, and I know that's a difficult one, but that's fine. I was going to tell you that I had planned to call you today because this subject is so interesting to me about the elections. I have two sons that are in their 40s, and I hear them, and they're active, by the way, in the political system, and I hear them saying things like, well, how are we going to know that our votes are going to even be counted? They are feeling like on the outside of things now, and I hate that.
Yeah.
And so where is the outrage? That's my question. Why aren't we thousands of us out in the streets saying, you cannot do this?
I think people these days are expressing outrage in different ways than they did 40, 50 years ago, frankly, Myrna. We don't have the leisure time that we had because people have to work two and three jobs to maintain a middle-class lifestyle,
true.
Whereas in the 1960s, one person could raise a family with a decent union job. And
true.
So there's not the free time. There's not the, kids are $40,000, $50,000 in debt after a couple of years of college back in the 60s when people were going out in the streets. Education was free in many states. I mean, it's a different time, and there's a different paradigm. Also, I think that there's a lot of the outrage being expressed on the Internet. A lot of the outrage is being expressed by calling members of Congress. There is a lot of activism going on. It's just not that very visible in the streets kind of activism. I'm not frankly sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that's how the paradigm has changed. But I'm telling you, there's a lot of, it's funny, yesterday I was talking, yesterday or the day before, we had a conversation here with the woman who is the head of the Union of Treasury Agents,
Right.
The IRS, and a couple of callers called into the show, didn't want to go on the air, just, let Lauren, our call screener, know that they had called, I guess it was Maria Cantwell's office was one of them, and, they were calling their senator and saying, don't privatize the IRS, and the senator's office said, we're getting all kinds of calls on this, what just happened? So people are getting active, people are outraged, people are speaking out.
I'm glad.
Yeah, and we just need to keep at it. We need to keep at it. Write letters to the editor of your newspaper, contact your elected officials, hold them accountable. I think that's the absolute key to it.
I do that, and I do really appreciate you. I mean, you have, with your education and with the history that you give us, it's marvelous. I can't praise you enough, and I have a lot of people listening.
Thank you, Myrna. It's much appreciated. Thank you for calling, too.
You're welcome.
And thanks for listening there on Talk 1090 in Seattle. Is it possible your human genes have already been patented? Author Matthew Albright will join us next with the biggest swindle of the 21st century. And then we're going to get back to, again, what can we do to recapture stolen elections? 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back to the program. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman with you. You know, sometimes you think you've got everything figured out. Sometimes you think you know what's up. You know what you don't know. But sometimes there's things that you don't know that you don't know that, as you know, to badly paraphrase Don Rumsfeld, that they'll get you. You know, there's sometimes even everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
They've patented your genes, or mine, or somebody else's. We have with us Matthew Albright. He's the author of a new book, Profits Pending, How Life Patents Represent the Biggest Swindle of the 21st Century. Bill McKibben wrote the foreword to this. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's an honor to be on your show.
I'm pleased to have you here. Let's just start out with the story of the Greenberg children as you open the book. This is a marvelous case in point of the madness of patenting what Bill McKibben says is the second most important invention in the history of the human race behind fire.
Right, right. The Greenberg children is basically the story of a group of families, including the Greenbergs, who got together to their children were born with a degenerative disease called Canavan's disease. And so these group of families got together with some researchers and kind of were interested, of course, in working for cures or at least an exploration of the disease, so that they could find out more about the disease. What turned out to happen is the researchers turned around and patented basically the basic genetic makeup of these children and the children of the Greenbergs and the children of other families. And now that patent lies with one hospital down in Florida. And if anybody, any other researchers, profit or nonprofit, want to study the Canavan disease, or at least the genetic implications of the Canavan disease, they have to pay licensing fees, they have to pay royalties to one particular institution. And this is just the broader case is basically
now on its surface, some folks would say, okay, you've got a rare disease, somebody's doing some research into that rare disease, that research may not necessarily be paying all that well if they can get a patent out of this in a way that's going to generate some profit for them. Won't that encourage things? Isn't that the American way? Isn't that the free market and all this? But the actual effect of this has been the opposite.
Yes. In fact, it actually dams up science. It actually slows down science. It goes against the whole constitutional reason for why we have patents, why we give ownership to certain interventions in the first place. And the basic idea here is what you're doing by patenting genetic material, basically the biology of humans, is you're patenting upstream knowledge. You're patenting stuff that's already there. You're patenting the knowledge that has to be studied. So this is different from somebody wanting to patent a drug that might cure a certain disease. These are companies, universities that are taking out ownership rights, basically, who are owning diseases. They are owning...
Well, it goes beyond diseases, doesn't it, Matthew Albright?
Absolutely. Whole plants. They're owning... there's over 600 patents on rice, patents on animals. Basically, it's as if you Galileo took out a patent on the moons of... the moons of Jupiter, right? And so that everybody who has to study, who wants to study the moons of Jupiter would have to give Galileo a licensing fee.
Now that sounds hyperbole, like hyperbole. I mean, that sounds. Come on.
Well, here we go. Let me use that.
Give us some examples. Make this real.
What's on the headlines right now are the stem cells. Stem cells, in fact, all stem cells are basically owned by the University of Wisconsin. All stem cells. They have three basic patents, and it's property rights, on stem cells that they were given well, throughout the last 7 years or so. And basically, if you want to study human embryonic stem cells, you have to pay them a licensing fee.
Is that only in the United States or anywhere in the world?
That is only in the United States. Although, as we see with globalization, as we see with the WTO and the TRIPS agreement, what we're trying to do is spread this kind of patenting of life and patenting our patenting laws throughout the world. So although it only applies to the United States, in fact, this is one of the reasons why they're saying there's a brain drain. We tend to blame, the President Bush and the theological reasons for stalling stem cells research. But
while our scientists are actually, we actually have American scientists trained in American universities, people who are American citizens, lived here, multi-generations, who are moving to other countries to get jobs in the sciences because, you could finish the sentence here for me, Matt.
Yes, absolutely, because one is the patenting rights. You can study stem cells without paying licensing fees to University of Wisconsin if you move to, say, Britain. So definitely the brain drain is not just a theological obstacle or a religious obstacle, but it's also one of patenting. You have to go through the University of Wisconsin. And in fact, California is now finding that California had Prop 71, 2004, where the taxpayers are actually going to give about $3 billion over the course of 10 years towards stem cells research. California decided they were going to go move ahead beyond waiting for federal money, so they were going to put their own monies into it. And University of Wisconsin has promised that they will charge the taxpayers, they will charge California for licensing to study stem cells. Now, this is not inventions. This is not, trying to get the royalties as inventions. This is just the basic picking up a Petri dish with stem cells and looking at it. You have to pay University of Wisconsin, the taxpayers of California now have to pay University of Wisconsin for that right to look.
So it is like if you wanted to look at Galileo's moons, at the moons that Galileo discovered, you would have to pay Galileo a fee every time you look through the telescope.
Absolutely. And in fact, what they call cluster patents, you would probably also have to pay Galileo to even use the telescope. So not only are they patenting the basic stuff, but they're patenting all the ways of getting to the basic stuff.
How have our patent laws gotten so crazy? We're talking with Matthew Albright. He's the author of Profits Pending, How Life Patents Represent the Biggest Swindle of the 21st Century. Who initiated this swindle? When did this really start?
Well, it's crazy, actually. When I first started looking at this, I thought it was hyperbole myself. I couldn't believe you could patent something that was naturally existed in the human body or that was growing in my field. It actually happened about 1980. Supreme Court looked at the Chakrabarty case, and basically they said it's okay to patent genetically modified organisms. That is, if you use the hand of man and you change an organism, you change a living thing or a gene, then you get to have a patent on it because they say, oh, here's something new.
Now,
however,
there's a certain amount of sense associated with that, isn't there?
Yes, and that makes a little sense. And I think it's been kind of a bureaucratic inertia that's kind of led to accepting patents which have no difference, genes which have no difference, biological molecules which have no difference from how they appear in nature.
Mm. So now we've leapt from that to you can patent anything as long as you can identify it. If you're the first person to identify it, you can patent it.
Exactly. It's exactly.
Has this been tested in the Supreme Court?
We haven't heard anything about this since 1980.
I would think that, if California is putting up billions of dollars for stem cell research and they're going to have to pay presumably millions of dollars to the University of Wisconsin just for the right to do stem cell research, that, they've got enough on the line that they would try and take this to the Supreme Court and get a definitive decision on this. Because stem cells haven't been discovered. They were there all along.
Yeah.
They haven't been created. They were discovered, but they were all there all along.
Exactly. And in fact, California, two watchdog groups just last month out of California have petitioned the Patent Office, not the Supreme Court, but the Patent Office to take a look at stem cells and say, look, this is very obvious. It's something that we all have. How can we pay for something that's already there? So we may see it in the headlines, but I think it's to put it in a larger framework, I think it's kind of the American way of No, we trust science. We trust capitalism.
Well, this is also how the seed companies are essentially raping the economies, the subsistence economies of India, Mexico, you know, the developing countries where people save seeds, you know, and they're coming in and saying, no, we own the patent on that seed now.
Absolutely, the same thing. It's
even if it's an original indigenous seed, not a genetically modified seed.
No, even, you know, basmati rice is what we're talking about. We're not talking about something that's been made with tomato.
Right. Stuff people have been growing for thousands of years. The drug companies just come in, or the big grain companies come in and say, well, we just patented that last week. You can't grow it anymore, even though, you know, 20 generations ago you were growing it.
Absolutely.
This is crazy. The book
crazy.
Profits Pending, How the Life Patents Threat the biggest represent the biggest swindle of the 21st century. Matthew Albright, is there a website for this, Matthew?
Actually, commoncouragepress.com is where you can get the book. So.
commoncouragepress.com. Thank you very much, Matthew, for being
thank
with
you
us.
Tom.
16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the True People's Radio.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, to cry all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit, and you ain't no friend of mine. Well, they said, and welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour, truth and common sense in broadcasting. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
It's official. Just following up on our conversation here a minute ago with Matthew Albright. It's official. This is from Greenpeace International. You can find it on their website. Monsanto Corporation is now out to own the world's food supply. The dangers of genetic engineering and reduced biodiversity notwithstanding, as they pigheadedly set about hog-tying farmers with their monopoly plans. We've discovered, they say, chilling evidence, new evidence, of this recent patent that seeks to establish ownership rights over pigs and their offspring. In the crop department, Monsanto is well on their way to dictating what consumers will eat, what farmers will grow, and how much Monsanto will get paid for. Bottom line, apparently some pig farmers were being sued for breeding pigs, of all things. Anyhow, that's the just, you can read all about it in Matthew's book. And the topics worthy of activism just never cease to amaze me, and yet they all boil down ultimately to one thing. They all boil down to the fundamental idea of, is this a nation and ultimately a world in which we're all in this together? The liberal ideal, right? This was the notion that Jean-Jacques Rousseau brought about, you know, popularized in the 1600s. That John Locke talked about, Locke had a few kind of royalist tendencies. But nonetheless, you know, he was very into private property, life, liberty, and private property. Jefferson changed that to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So the transition from the Enlightenment through the American Revolution, pretty clear. From the mid-1600s to the late 1700s, where we said, we went from saying, we're all in this alone. You know, my family versus your family, my community versus your community, that kind of mentality. Our king versus their king, you know, our army versus, to maybe we can be cooperative, maybe we can work things out together. We're all in this world together. Yes, there's some crazy people among us, and yes, we have to do something about them. We need to isolate them. We need to restrain them. We need to imprison them. I mean, yes, absolutely, there are times to do that. But at the core of it, the conservative philosophy fundamentally says every man for himself, and it's usually men, by the way. It's one of the reasons that five of the six Iroquois nations only allowed women to vote. You're very wise. They got it. If you're going to have a constitutional rule, as the Iroquois did, that requires all decisions to be made in the context of their impact on the seventh generation, you better be listening to the people who have the greatest connection to the seventh generation, to future generations. While the men are out there running around killing off each other trying to, you know, testosterone-driven behavior. The women were connected and are, continue to be. Helen Caldicott was in this studio last week talking about, you know, the madness of, it's going to be her next book, she says, Why Men Kill. But I digress. Actually, I think that that there's culture in this as well. I agree with Leonard Schlain. Leonard Schlain wrote this brilliant book called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess. And the last time, Len Schlain and I spoke at a conference together in someplace on the East Coast about 8 years ago, 7, 8 years ago, right after his book came out. And we had lunch together and talked about this. And it's just amazing. What he discovered was that prior to, and I realize this is a digression, but this is so cool. I just have to share this with you. That prior to written language, that cultures were largely egalitarian, and religions usually had women as well as men, female as well as male deities. And when we started using pictographs, where there were hundreds or thousands of different little pictures to describe things, we continued to have female and male deities, and cultures continued to be largely egalitarian. There are differences between men and women, but their relative levels of power were about the same in society. And then Schlain identifies the point at which we started using an abstract alphabet, where a letter has a sound but not a meaning, and constructing words out of these sounds. And this requires the left hemisphere of the brain that controls the right side of the body. This requires the left hemisphere of the brain to essentially grow faster when the alphabet is learned before the age of 7 and take over. And you end up, he documents this in ancient Europe. It's fascinating. You look at there was a time for a few hundred years where it was illegal to teach children to read. Unless they were going to go into the priesthood, where the Catholic Church ruled. And during that time, goddess worship in Europe exploded. It was the cult of Mary. Within a few generations of the church allowing reading, and printing coming into vogue, within a few generations of that, according to Schlain, within 2 generations of that, over 1 million women had been put to death. The men rose up. They were put to death as witches, by and large. And because, he says, what happened was children learning how to read caused their left hemisphere to take over, the male-dominated part of the brain, and all this weird behavior erupted. So, anyhow, we'll get back to voting right after this. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I said see, right. Oh, see what you have done. I said see, right. Oh, see what you have done. How can you make me love you?
And welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Boy, Marian Delgado in the chat room really taking me to task. Tom, the idea that females are born morally superior is the very kind of thinking the other way that kept women from voting. And saying that I just went on a sexist and inaccurate rant. I respectfully disagree. I remember a few years ago I was sitting with a friend of mine, Ned Halliwell. He's a professor of psychiatry at Harvard University. We were doing a speaking tour together of the Southwest. This is probably, 7, 8 years ago. And talking about drug abuse. And he said, you know, you think heroin is bad, cocaine is bad. He said the most dangerous substance on earth is testosterone. It's caused all the wars. I mean, it's just... Now, that doesn't mean the men are morally inferior. See, this is the point that I was trying to make with regard to Leonard Schlain's hypothesis. That's where it actually gives us hope, and there's actually something we can do about it. Schlain suggests, and by the way, he wasn't the first to come up with this. Walter Ong wrote a book called Oral Sea and Literacy back in the 1960s or 1970s that put forth this hypothesis. Maria Gambutis used to write about this. My dear friend Rianne Eisler has written a series of books about this. Daniel Quinn talks about it. He credits Rianne Eisler for much of this. The the question that has been debated for as long as there is civilization is, why is it that in some societies men and women have relatively equal power? In other words, men are not born inherently morally inferior or more likely or more, you know, with a greater tendency towards violence. Why is it that in some societies men and women have relatively equal power, and in other societies they don't? And there's been this big battle, this big debate about this, been going on among anthropologists and sociologists for as long as there has been the observation of it. I mean, it started with Rousseau, really. I mean, we were talking about Rousseau earlier, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and his idea of the noble savage, as the Europeans in the 1600s were discovering tribal people who had not had contact with Europeans, and the tribal people were living in harmony and peace in many cases. Now, in some cases, they were warlike, but in many cases, they were living in harmony and peace. And the Europeans were asking themselves, what is it that they have that we don't have? What do they know that we don't know? And that's what led, in some part, to the Renaissance and directly to American democracy. So anyhow, this debate has been going on, and Maria Gimbutas, who wrote a series of books about goddesses in history, and you just go to Amazon.com or Powell's.com or whatever and type in Gimbutas, G-I-M-B-U-T-A-S, or you can Google her very easily, I'm sure. Maria Gimbutas came up with this theory that Rhianne Eisler subscribes to, that it had to do with the development of animal agriculture, that when we became pastoralists, and this was around 5,000-7,000 years ago, when humans stopped just being hunter-gatherers and pure agriculturalists, but became pastoralists, people had to develop relationships with animals that they then had to kill to eat. In other words, you know, keeping sheep, goats, cows. And that inured us to violence. And that led directly to the Kurgan, the Caucasians coming out of the Caucasus Mountains and riding into the Middle East and the rest of Europe and bringing violence as a way of life. Now, that's been one of the main theories for the last 30 years. And then Walter Ong came along with his book, Oralcy and Literacy, and said, no, it's not. It's not that, because there are societies, and by the way, there are those who suggest that the Old Testament was a warning about this. In Genesis, where Cain and Abel come before God, and Cain is the hunter-gatherer, and Abel is the farmer. Excuse me, it's the other way around. Cain was the farmer, and Abel was the one who had, you know, he was a hunter-gatherer, and he was also keeping animals. But Cain was the farmer, and they give their offerings to God. And Cain gives his offering of farm stuff, and Abel gives his, you know, he hunted some animals. Here's some meat, and God says, "I don't want Cain's stuff." Right? Or I don't want Cain's stuff. I don't want the agriculture stuff. And Cain gets so angry that he kills Abel over it. Abel, the good guy, the guy who was the hunter gatherer, not the farmer. And some suggest that that was a warning. Don't go down that road of intensive agriculture, animal agriculture. Don't do that. A warning from ancient people to us. Obviously a warning that we ignored. So anyhow, Walter Ong came along, and Leonard Schlain, who is a neurosurgeon, in his book The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, came along and said, no, it's not intrinsic to men and women. It's cultural. And this builds on the work of the German, it was a German fellow who created Rudolf Steiner, who created a whole series of schools and things, the Waldorf schools. And Steiner in the 1920s, now, before this debate was happening with Schlain and Ong, Steiner came along and said, children should not learn how to read before the age of 7, because if they learn how to read before the age of 7, they're more likely to be violent. And Hitler actually pursued him, I mean, chased him all over the world trying to kill him in the 1930s. And it was really quite an incredible story of Rudolf Steiner. And it turns out, according to Schlein, that's the stage in brain development where if you learn how to read before the age of seven, and by the way, in Sweden, they don't teach you how to read before the age of seven. And yet their kids graduate from school at the age of 16 with a better education than ours do at the age of 18. Interesting stuff, huh? And they also tend not to be violent. The Swedes who back, you know, a couple hundred years ago, when they were teaching their kids at earlier ages, were, you know, along with the Vikings, the scourge of Northern Europe. In any case, what Schlein is saying is that by learning an abstract alphabet, by learning an abstraction, an alphabet that only has 30 or 40 characters, and all meaning comes from just those 30 or 40 characters, it causes the brain to develop abnormally and causes both men and women, although particularly men, to have that left hemisphere dominance that, according to Schlein, is not the normal thing. The normal thing is bi-hemispheric dominance, you know, both sides of the brain working cooperatively. And when one side of the brain takes over, the left side of the brain takes over, then you end up with cultures, dominator cultures, these younger cultures, these more violent cultures. I think it's just a fascinating hypothesis. So, anyhow, pardon me for going off on that, but occasionally you need to get into thinking about these things. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I think that's very fascinating, too. And in fact, whenever you were talking about Hitler chasing that guy to kill him, it reminded me of the story of Bee.
Yeah, Daniel Quinn's book.
Right.
Yeah. Dan Quinn was really into this stuff. He got started, you know, what got him started in writing Ishmael was reading Rhianne Eisler's work.
I have to check her out.
Rhianne Eisler wrote The Goddess and the Spear. The Goddess and I'd have to go back and look. I know Rhianne and her husband David Loy, they're good friends, but I'm not pulling up the name of her. She also wrote Sacred Pleasures I'd have to Google her. Anyway, continue. I'm sorry.
That's okay. This discussion of patenting naturally occurring substances, it's like a trifecta convergence of, one, corporate profit over everything, and two, ignorance of science to know the difference between a naturally occurring substance and its altered state, and three, the FEMA-izing of the governmental agencies. It should remain neutral in, for example, in making the distinction between naturally occurring substances and altered substances, which would result in really promoting the general welfare of us, we the people, while not impeding truly beneficial technological advances.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always very, very concerned, like you were talking about the technology for the babies. I'm trying to remember because the checking them out before they're born.
Yes.
The ultrasound.
Yep.
You know, that's how they can make money is through technology. So there might be some other things that I don't know about predicting what a child is, the sex and whatnot. I don't know if we need to know that, to be honest with you. But I think we're getting off the wrong path, and there may be other ways to fix ourselves for health and things of that nature instead of these technological and so-called technological advances.
Yeah, I agree. Bonnie, well said. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. Rhianne Eisler's books, Sacred Pleasures, Sex, Myth, and the Politics of the Body, The Chalice and the Blade, Our History, Our Future. That's, I think, one of her most important books. The Power of Partnership, her most recent book is, I believe it's her most recent book, and she and her husband David Loy run the Center for Partnership Studies, partnershipway.org, and I believe I'm on their advisory board. At least I was at one point in time. Clint Curtis is on the line. Clint, hey, Clint, we're going to have to take a break in about 1 minute, I think. So let me get you started. We'll take a break, and then we'll come back on that. Tell me, what's you're running for Congress from Florida.
We're running for Congress in Florida now.
Taking on Tom Feeney. I think that's absolutely marvelous. Tom Feeney came to you when you were a computer programmer and said what?
Well, back in 2000, he wanted a prototype for a program that would work on touchscreen machines that would allow him to decide who won elections.
And to decide who won elections or to make someone win an election?
Make someone win the election, basically so that he could determine who the winner was, regardless of the vote count.
And did you write that program?
Yes.
And did you deliver it to Tom Feeney?
actually delivered it to the owner of the company, thinking that this was a program they're going to use to stop vote fraud. Basically, here's the program, here's how you stop it. And she says, you don't understand, this is for flipping the vote in South Florida.
And this was before the 2000 election?
Yes, in September, right before the 2000 election.
Amazing. Clint Curtis, I want to hear the rest of the story, and I know you're running for Congress. We need to get your website and all that kind of stuff. Stick around. Let me put you on hold here, and we will be back with Clint Curtis and your calls and so much more. I've also got an Iraq update here. Hopefully we'll have time for 46 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartmann Radio Program.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Will the world turn? And a hungry little boy with a runny nose plays in the street as the cold wind blows in the ghetto. And his hunger burns. So he starts to roam the streets at night, and he learns how to steal, and he learns how to fight in the ghetto.
And welcome back. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in Little Beirut. An ironic time for that name to be applied to Portland by George Bush Sr. Tom Hartmann here with you, 9 minutes before the hour. We're going to get back to Clint Curtis in just a second. First, however, we do need to check in on what's going on with the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the camps. And there is blood on the wire.
Following our security incidents in Iraq, reported on Wednesday as of 0945 GMT, in Basra, armed gangs of men attacked the city council and governor's office in Iraq's second largest city south of Baghdad and exchanged heavy machine gun fire with Iraqi army and police. In Mosul, 6 insurgents killed and 7 wounded in clashes between them and police in the northern city of Mosul. In Baghdad, 8 people were killed and 28 wounded when a roadside bomb went off at a flea market beside a highway flyover in eastern Baghdad. In Basra, Yasif al-Musawi, the secretary general of the Tharala Islamic Party, one of the Shiite Islamist parties, escaped an assassination attempt when 2 roadside bombs went off near his house in Basra. In Jabala, 3 Iraqi soldiers were killed and 4 wounded late on Tuesday by a roadside bomb near their patrol in that town. In Musayab, gunmen wounded 2 people late on Tuesday. In Kut, 2 policemen were wounded late Tuesday by a roadside bomb. And near Hilla, gunmen attacked an Iraqi army checkpoint near that town. Soldiers ran off and the attackers stole their weapons, according to police. And finally, an average of more than 110 Iraqis per day were killed in the month of July. Now that the official figures are out today, at least 3,438 civilians died violently during that month, a 9% increase over the tally in June, twice as many in January. The civil war is on. I mean, there's just no other way. Edward Wong and Damian Cave write in the New York Times, the rising numbers indicate that sectarian violence is spiraling out of control and seem to bolster an assertion that many senior Iraqi officials and American military analysts have been making in recent months, that the country is already embroiled in a civil war, not just slipping toward one, and that the American-led forces are caught between Sunni Arab guerrillas and Shiite militias. Back to Clint Curtis. Clint Curtis, so you delivered, you were asked by the company you were working for in Florida to write software that would hack a Diebold voting machine and allow it to flip an election. And you wrote this software and you delivered it to Congressman Tom Feeney, who was then the chairman, he was then the Speaker of the House of Representatives in the state of Florida, right?
Wrong. This was not designed for a Diebold or anything. They basically asked for a prototype of a system that would be able to flip the vote.
Yeah, on any machine.
Any machine, including scanners. So scanners are not safe.
Right. And you wrote this, and this is not rocket science. I'm assuming any competent computer programmer could have done the same?
Most incompetent computer programmers to write a simple program like this. It's very simple.
Okay. It's
very
simple. You wrote this and you delivered it to Congressman Feeney. He then went on to run for the United States Congress from Florida and on voting machines and won, and where he sits now. Has he acknowledged that you wrote vote flipping software for him?
No. He says he can't remember ever having a meeting with me.
Does he acknowledge?
Originally, he couldn't remember meeting me, and now it's down to he couldn't remember a meeting with me. So.
Does he acknowledge his relationship with the company that you were working for?
He does. Well, it's really hard to get away from that because, you know, they've been his big donors for years, and he was their corporate attorney, their chief lobbyist. At the same time, he was Speaker of the House.
Why has he not, you know, if he says that you're making this stuff up, why has he not sued you for libel or something?
Or just taken the polygraph test I've challenged him to take for 4 years now or so.
Ah, so that's true. The truth is the best defense. We're talking with Clint Curtis. Clint, if somebody wants to support your candidacy in Florida to run against Tom Feeney for the House of Representatives from Florida, what's the website?
Website is www.clintcurtis.com.
That's
I will
pretty
also
easy to remember.
Be in Seattle on the 17th, tomorrow, actually.
Okay, and tomorrow in Seattle, you'll be where and when?
I will be at the Seattle Labor Temple, 2800 First Avenue. And if they need tickets or something to come, I'm going to show the program. I'm going to walk them through the whole thing. You know, the more people that know, the quicker we'll get our democracy back. And hopefully
is this movie about you or this program about you available on your website at clintcurtis.com, Clint?
I don't know.
Well, let's suggest that you put it up there.
I don't really know.
Yeah.
I guess I should put it up there, huh?
Yeah, I think it would be a good plan. Clint Curtis, great talking with you, and good luck in Seattle tomorrow, Clint.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot for calling in. Amazing. Coming up on tomorrow's program, Congressman John Conyers is here about his new report on the Bush-Cheney crimes. It's titled The Constitution in Crisis. And I'll finally be agreeing with a conservative, Stephen Slavinsky, who says, he has a new book, Buck Wild, How Republicans Broke the Bank and Became the Party of Big Government. That and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. And remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.